If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
From the Wall Street Journal, this is Instant Message. I'm David Pierce. This week on the show, we'll figure out what's going on with Huawei and whether the company's spying on us like some people are afraid. Later, I'll be chatting with writer and director Matthew Carnahan, the creator of a new show called Valley of the Boom that's all about the first days of the internet. And in a few minutes, we'll help you remember your friends' birthdays without needing Facebook to remind you. But first, there's going to be a new Motorola Razr, which is a sentence I haven't said out loud in like 12 years. And I'm strangely excited about it, and I feel like the fact that it's coming back says a lot about the smartphone market. So let's get into that. Here with me, as always, Joanna Stern in New York and Christopher Mims in Baltimore. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
Christopher, how's the attic?
It's fantastic. It's lit up by the dull glow of David Beckham advertising the Razr.
What? Amazing. Those were the best
on
ads.
On a wall? You have
On my big screen.
Oh, so I thought you had an old poster.
An old poster of the last time that he was advertising for the Razr?
Yeah. Just up on your wall.
Not quite.
So Joanna, the Razr is coming back, but it's not like, actually, wait, before we even get to that, did you guys have Razrs back in the day?
Nope. I didn't.
I had a very awful boss who had one, so I don't have good associations. I just think of it as the showiest, like, look how tiny my phone is. Like in Zoolander, you know?
Totally. I really wanted one, but I believe it was like an exclusive on AT&T or Singular at the time. And I was on Verizon. And I couldn't get it, or like when it became available, I had already gotten a different phone. But I did have an awesome LG flip phone with a color screen on the outside.
Nice. I was just on that like crappy snake playing Nokia forever. And all my friends had Razrs, and I thought they were much cooler than I was. And I remember being, I really don't think I've ever been jealous of a phone like I was the Razr, despite the fact that I actually don't think it was that good a phone. But anyway, so the thrust of this phone, what we know so far, right, is that we think it's going to come out pretty soon. It's going to be from Lenovo, which now owns Motorola, after Motorola has been sort of bought and sold, you know, 150 different times since the first Razr. It's going to be a foldable phone, and it's apparently going to be very exclusive, right? Am I missing anything? What else do we know about this phone?
I think that sums up the big scoop. This was a big Wall Street Journal scoop. This is not, we should also say, not official news. The companies have not announced this. Just our wonderful reporters, Sarah Krause and Rob Barry, have uncovered this.
Oh, and it's going to cost $1,500. Did I say that yet? $1,500.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy.
So as we've seen with the foldable phone, the first one that came out at CES, this thing could maybe it folds like a map and just folds out to a laptop. Who knows?
That would be amazing.
Yeah, I mean, also like,
it's going to fold in half. Do you think it's going to be a smartphone? First
what if
question.
What if the reporting, I mean, I trust our reporters, but like, what if the reporting is really just it's a flip phone and that is what's foldable?
So
for $1,500 question.
Yeah. Samsung has been selling these Android powered flip phones for a while, and they only sell them, I think, in Asia. But every time a new one comes out, it's shockingly expensive for a flip phone, but it runs Android. It has all the apps. And a big part of me always kind of wants it. I don't know. It's such an interesting thing coming on the heels of this Apple and Samsung thing where nobody can figure out how to sell a lot of smartphones anymore. Like, is this just going to be a year of everybody grasping at straws trying to find some new or old way to sell new phones? Is this just like the Spider-Man reboot of phones?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's also unclear from our reporting if it's like really a full-on smartphone, if this wants to be another one of those sort of like companion devices like the Palm that you just reviewed, David, or wrote about. The like, is this an alternative to an iPhone or a high-end Android phone, or is this like something so exclusive but like tries to market as you don't really need to do all those other things?
For $1,500,
$1,500, they're still going to go in the maximalist direction, unfortunately, because I was hoping that you know, maybe we had an early lead on like, no, it truly is a $1,500 flip phone. Believe it. And then I was like, I bet you celebrities are going to be sporting this solely because, you know, that's the definition of luxury. It's a thing you don't need that costs too much. And therefore, its exclusivity is increased because nobody can justify the purchase based on its utility. So my hope is that it is a true old school flip phone, in which case I think that they're not going to sell a lot, but it will mark a cultural moment. I'll be disappointed if it's just a fold-up phone like we saw at CES, because that I think is more of the same and what people don't want.
Yeah, I agree with you on one thing. They're not going to sell a lot of these. I mean,
well, I think our story even said they're only planning to make like 200,000 of them, which is a crazy small number.
I mean, I would be surprised they can even sell that.
I mean, I'd buy one. I don't not You're even
buy,
what it is.
Right, but it's $1,500. It's we don't know. It's some random kind of new wacky form factor, and it's a Verizon exclusive.
If David Beckham has one, it makes no sense. I also have one. No, it really doesn't make any sense. And I keep hearing people comparing the foldable phone thing to 3D TVs, which is just a technology nobody's asking for. And like I used that Royal phone at CES, which is the first foldable phone. And it's too big and too heavy and the thing doesn't work that well. But it's cool. There's just something about it I really like in a way that I never felt about 3D TV.
I liked your like your kind of playing on it in the video because it's just like it looks ridiculous. But like, can we really call that a phone? Isn't it really just a folding tablet? It's like a folding screen.
That's fair. We are going to need a new name for this.
Like it doesn't look like what it just looked like this like giant thing that you would carry around. It's not a phone.
True. No, it was. I mean, it was the size of like a paperback book. It was a big thing. That would not fit in my pocket by any stretch of the imagination.
So what are you going to call it then?
I don't know.
Phablet.
A phablet, but with an F instead of
a A phablet, but with an F.
A foldable. Yes. That is good, guys. We should. We
phablet.
I'm calling legal right now. We need to register this.
This is good. Here comes the phablet.
It's not bad. So I want to talk about a story that's been in the news for a while now, but that I honestly still don't really understand. Here's what I do know. Huawei, the giant Chinese conglomerate that makes phones and networking equipment and laptops and who knows what else, has a lot of people in the U.S. nervous about something related to spying. The government has even warned that people shouldn't buy Huawei phones because they'll apparently allow China to spy on us, which is honestly a shame because Huawei's recent phones are as good as anybody's. I'm sitting here in front of a Huawei laptop, too, and I want to know if I need to stop. So that's why we have Stu Wu in our London bureau, who's been reporting on this Huawei story a lot recently. It's late in London, Stu, but thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. Hello. Hello, America.
So let's just start at the sort of highest level here. What do we know about what Huawei has been doing? There's these worries that they're going to spy on us, essentially, at like the highest level. Is that happening? Do we know that Huawei is spying on Americans? Should we be afraid of this?
Yeah, let's start with that. The U.S. government has never actually provided any evidence that Huawei is spying on anybody. It's all about the theoretical threat that a Chinese company can't refuse a request by the Chinese government to hand over data or to conduct spying if Beijing wants them to.
Okay. So where did this come from? I mean, there are lots of companies in China that we could theoretically worry about spying on us. So why has Huawei been so much in the news over the last few months?
Yeah, that's true. It's because Huawei is the only really, truly global Chinese technology company. You think about Alibaba and Tencent, but they're largely Chinese players. Huawei is the number two maker of smartphones in the world, behind Samsung, ahead of Apple. And they're the number one maker of the stuff that goes into cell towers and internet networks that guys like Comcast and AT&T and Verizon would use if they weren't banned in America. Here's the thing. It's you know how your iPhone bugs you every month or two to update its software? Well, when you hit accept, you don't really know what's going in there. You just trust that Apple's not going to put something in there that's going to listen to your phone calls or send your data to the NSA or something like that. So what the U.S. government's worried about is that, okay, you have not only the smartphones, but you have the cell towers that all our calls go through. They're worried that if Beijing said, hey, we want you to spy on Americans, you got to do it. Anybody can do it. So there's Nokia can do it. They're the number two maker of cell tower equipment. Ericsson, number three, they can do it. The difference is that Nokia is based in Finland. Ericsson's based in Sweden. The Americans don't think the Finns and the Swedes are going to ask those companies to spy on us. But they do think that Beijing might.
Sorry to break in, but Stu, I'm just really curious about if the concern is that none of these companies can refuse a request by the Chinese government. Why hasn't this concern spread to Xiaomi or Tencent or Alibaba, you know, and their products like WeChat, you know, or has it?
I haven't heard those concerns yet. But if you look at Alibaba, they do cloud computing now, but they're not really big outside of China. The difference is that Huawei is the number one maker of this network equipment, the cell tower equipment and the internet routers. They're all over Europe. They're in Mexico. They're integrated in these networks. And unlike a cell phone where, okay, maybe 15% of the population buys a cell phone, maybe you can spy on 15% of those people, with cell tower equipment, you don't really know whose cell tower equipment you're using. So the U.S. government's worried, okay, they could spy maybe through people who buy their laptops and cell phones. They know what they're getting into. If they're in cell towers, they could be spying on everybody within, you know, half mile radius of that cell tower.
So the answer for David, who's using a Huawei laptop for some reason, and as I also want to talk about the weird webcam that he has on that laptop, but that's another discussion, is that it doesn't even matter if Huawei makes the devices in our hands or on our desks or in our pockets. It's that Huawei controls everything that connects to them.
That's it. I mean, if you're using the internet right now and you've got Comcast or AT&T or Time Warner, you don't know who's making the equipment. It could be Cisco, it could be Juniper, it could be a few other companies. But the worry is that if Huawei is one of those companies, well, they could be passing on that data to the Chinese government.
And so you cover Huawei. Where are you out of?
I'm in London. And I know that's a weird spot to write about Huawei, but Europe's their biggest market outside of China. And they're in the UK networks. You can't use the internet in the UK, basically, without having your data path through Huawei equipment.
Because I went to Huawei's campus in outside Shenzhen a couple of years ago, and it just, you know, at that point, I just sort of thought of Huawei as making phones, and they had been rising in the ranks in terms of phone sales, and I had no clue what I was walking into. And it was this giant, sprawling campus, and it kind of became clear to me, and I mean, maybe it's just my American view of the world, because our companies don't, like, when we go visit campuses of our American tech companies, they don't look anything like this, but it was like huge sprawling campus, which is like basically like castles. And it became pretty clear to me that like Huawei is basically China. They're so close to the government and so close to, I don't know, being like this supreme company. Is that also part of the concern?
Yeah, part of the concern is that, and I don't know whether Huawei is as closely linked to the Chinese government like Alibaba or Tencent is. We did a series of stories last year that said, well, those companies have to hand over data to the authorities. I haven't really seen any stories or reporting along those lines connecting Beijing and Huawei. But their founder is a former engineer for the People's Liberation Army in China. So that could be, that's something that the U.S. government points to all the time. And he's a member of the Communist Party. He said he's proud of it, but that doesn't mean that we, you know, give our data over to the Chinese government. That's what he said a couple days ago in a really rare media appearance.
Yeah, so how big a deal was it that he actually came out and said that? Because it seemed like my impression was this is not a thing that happens. But here, you know, that would have happened much more quickly, I would think. So like how big a deal is it that statement actually came out?
Yeah, I think he hadn't spoken in 3 years. You know, Jack Ma at Alibaba has been out there, and Mr. Ren, as they call him, at Huawei is the opposite of that. He's given, I think, maybe two interviews over the past decade or two, or maybe two interviews ever, at least that the Western media has reported on. So, no, this was a big deal. He usually delegates all the talking to the three CEOs that he has. He has three CEOs under him that rotate. He compares it to like birds flying in a V formation where the bird in front helps to reduce the drag for the birds behind him.
He refers to that?
It's a lot of CEOs.
Yeah, that is three rotating CEOs. I think they take 6 months at a time. Can you imagine if we had three editors-in-chief that rotated every 6 months?
No, thanks.
Is there any evidence that damage, that there will be fallout from these actions for Huawei's brand, you know, in countries where it is being sold, and it hasn't, I mean, you know, it's been banned in telecommunications systems in the US, but you said it's in Mexico, it's elsewhere. Is there a danger that in the future people won't buy it?
Yeah, it's already starting. So their biggest business, their most important business is selling these cell tower equipment and internet routers to wireless and internet providers around the world. So they're basically banned in the US and Australia right now. And now their most important market outside China is Europe. So the UK is reviewing whether they want to keep on buying stuff from Huawei or allowing their private internet and wireless companies to keep buying from Huawei. A big deal happened in Germany. Germany was really skeptical of the U.S. arguments. They said, hey, the Americans haven't shown us any evidence of wrongdoing. But they're considering an unofficial ban on Huawei, where they basically put in so many technical restrictions that Huawei couldn't possibly comply with them, but the Western companies could. And France has a similar unofficial ban on them. So if Germany decides to do that, dominoes might fall in Europe, and you might see Poland, Spain, the UK. But we don't really know. But things are happening here in Europe right now.
Is there any indication that they finally have evidence that they didn't have before?
That's a great question that my editor keeps on asking me about. I don't know why the reversal right now, but one big thing that happened this past week was that about a week ago was that Poland arrested the sales director in the country, the Huawei sales director in Poland, and said that he was conducting high-level spying for the Chinese government. So if you're a U.S. government official, that's like manna from heaven. Like, okay, even if they did have evidence, they don't need to reveal their hand right now because they can just say, hey, look at Poland. The guy who's heading the office, the sales office there, is a spy for the Chinese. What more do you need to know?
And to be clear, though, Huawei has said he acted alone and they fired him, right?
Yeah, absolutely. As far as we know, there's no smoking gun that Huawei has ever spied on anybody. And just a side note, spying is one thing. The other thing that the U.S. government's afraid of is that they could just hit a button to turn off communications in a country. So let's say one theoretical example I got was that if the U.S. and China get an armed conflict over Taiwan, well, Huawei might be able to turn off communications at an airport somewhere in around the South China Sea.
That's where this whole thing starts to get sort of interestingly political to me in a way where it, like, what's your sense of how much this is about sort of political posturing between countries? We're having a trade war, and obviously there's this U.S. versus China sort of tech race, and Huawei would be an easy target to try and, you know, bleed out of being globally dominant when we have Qualcomm and companies we'd like to be in that race. Like, how much of this is just, I don't know, talk into some extent?
If you talk to a cybersecurity expert, the risk is real. Any of these companies that make cell tower equipment or internet routers have the ability to spy on a network or to just turn it off with a press of a button. I want to clarify, this is not part of Trump's trade war, trade dispute. There have been folks in China Hawks, basically, in Washington that have been paying attention to this since 2007, since the George W. Bush administration. But part of it is an economic worry that if China gets, say, 5G way before America does, then more jobs will start flowing to China. They'll develop self-driving cars first. And maybe if you're a scholar from, I don't know, Europe, you might want to go to Shenzhen in China instead of Silicon Valley because they have better technology and you can work on cutting edge stuff there.
And can you explain what happened with ZTE? Because that feels like a not quite exact precedent, but something similar happened with ZTE that we're also having debates with Huawei. And I mean, as best I can tell, it almost broke ZTE.
So ZTE, just think of ZTE as Huawei's, let's say, little cousin in China. The difference, one big difference between ZTE and Huawei is that ZTE is owned by a state-controlled company, so they actually have some direct government relationship there. But ZTE is the number four maker of cell tower equipment in the world, and they also make smartphones. And what they got in trouble for was, number one, they were found in violation of sanctions related to Iran and other countries. That was part of the problem, and they settled that, and then they ended up breaking it, and that's where they got into trouble, and that's when the U.S. government said, the Commerce Department said, hey, American companies can't export stuff to them, the chips that you need to make your internet router, cell tower equipment, and smartphones, and it turns out that you still need American components to make technology anywhere in the world, and it took an intervention by President Trump to stop that. And that's where it gets interesting, right? Because you have these national security folks in Washington saying this is a national security issue, but the president himself has been using these issues as a chip in his trade dispute with China.
So, and then in the midst of all of this, Huawei is making consumer electronics that it wants to sell everywhere. Like you said, it's the second biggest phone seller in the world, and they make these great phones that are sort of increasingly technically advanced above a lot of others, and they make laptops and are getting into lots of different things. So, like, for regular people, especially here, trying to figure out what to do about all of this, is it just like hope nothing bad happens? Because even if you don't use Huawei, like you were saying, you might end up on Huawei equipment at some point. So, like, what do we do in the midst of all this?
It's funny. One of my friends, who's Chinese American, actually got a Huawei phone from her boyfriend because she lost hers, and she said, "I'm not going to use this. You know, this is I'm worried about spying." I think if people out there don't have any concerns about spying, if they don't think they have anything any data worth spying on, it's probably fine. If you're in America, it's really unlikely that any of your communications are going through Huawei equipment. Basically, only rural carriers that slipped under the national radar that the national security folks can keep an eye on use that stuff. So it's probably not a worry if you're in the U.S. or in Australia, where it's basically banned. It's a really complicated issue. I mean, with the trade stuff and ZTE complicates it all. I wish it were just Huawei and there were no trade thing going on, but that's the world we live in now.
Got it. Anything else for Stu?
That was a lot of good stuff. Thank you, Stu.
Yeah. Yeah, thank cool. you, Sue.
All right.
Okay, let's move on to a company that is definitely spying on us, Facebook. Joanna, you wrote a story this week about Facebook's birthday reminders, which I realized in talking to you about this is like 80% of the reason I'm still on Facebook. So what was your story and what can you do to help us?
My story was basically that Facebook is ruining birthdays. When people are leaving Facebook or quitting Facebook or even just not using it as much anymore, they are forgetting people's birthdays. But then there's the flip side of that, too, which is that they're no longer on Facebook, so no one remembers their birthdays. So basically, it's just no one remembers birthdays anymore. And Facebook was the most used, most invasive birthday keeper on the internet. That was my story.
That's sort of scary.
Yeah. I mean, it's really just this funny fallout story that I actually noticed when it was my birthday back in December. I was like, I'm not getting that many wishes on Facebook anymore. And I realized that I never log into Facebook that much anymore. So I never wish people a happy birthday. And I forgot my best friend's birthday a couple of months ago because I just forgot to look at Facebook, right? And it wasn't a really big drama because, like, we're older now and it's okay if you don't remember people's birthdays. No one cries about it. But I was like, I bet there's something there. And so when I started talking to people, it turns out like, yeah, lots of people are forgetting people's birthdays. And I think the funniest story in my piece is this woman who's I think she's 30, and her 86-year-old grandma forgot her birthday because she wanted to know, why didn't Facebook remind me?
I like it. So it's kind of like, do you remember that moment when we all went from memorizing phone numbers to just putting them in your phone and not ever even learning them? I feel
yes.
like it's sort of the same thing where all of a sudden it's like, okay, I don't have to remember your birthday. Facebook will tell me when it is. And now it's back to like, oh crap, I'm going to have to actually like go out of my way to remember when your birthday is.
Yeah. And that's another like really funny thing in the story. This is not one of my columns. This was an A-head for our page one sort of daily A-head series, which we've talked about on the podcast before. And the I think the funniest thing of the story are these people. And it turned out to be a trend because I started interviewing a bunch of people and I was like, that's three people who have told me now that they, before leaving Facebook or quitting Facebook, got a notebook, a physical paper notebook and a pen, and wrote down birth dates in a book and then decided to leave Facebook. So
wow.
You know, yes, there's and do talk about in the piece, there's obviously lots of people that are exporting the digital version of that and they're putting it into their Google calendars, Apple calendars, et cetera. But these people who are physically writing them down in the books say they've got new methods to remembering birthdays. And by new methods, I mean really old methods.
Okay, so wait, but explain the digital thing, because I feel like that's the most
practical
solution. It's get it out of Facebook and put it into your calendar somewhere.
Yeah, so it's really hard to find. I feel like it used to be easier to find, though Facebook wouldn't confirm that. You have to go on the Facebook website. You have to go on your laptop, on the desktop version. You go to the events tab, and it's really buried there. Like, the best thing you can do is just do Control F, do a find, and you want to look for the text that says, you can add your events to Microsoft Outlook, Google Calendar, or Apple Calendar. So you look for this little box, and then below that it says birthdays, or it also says events. You want to click the birthdays one. You click the birthdays one. It downloads a calendar file. It's an ICS calendar file. You go to whatever calendar app you use, Apple Calendar, or if you're using a Mac, whatever the Windows alternative is. You can even go to your Google Calendar, and then you import that file. Oh, and pro tip, you can open that file if you don't like want to take your 70,000 friends from Facebook and import them to your birthdays, all of their birthdays, like chances are you maybe can't care about like seven of those. You can go into the file, you can delete the other ones, and then import it.
That's going to be a thing that takes like much too long, but it's probably really useful.
Yeah, or just like search for the right one. Like you can just go in there, search for the names you want, then go to your calendar and type them in.
That's actually true. Like I could probably list the people whose birthdays I care about off the top of my head, and they would just be in
there. This is a great example of how data portability is like now law in the EU. But the process you just described, how many people are really going to do that?
I mean, not a lot.
It's so much work.
It's hard to find.
Also, can I just say that as with your previous reporting, moving the needle on like laptop keyboards and such, my prediction is as a result of this column that you wrote, we are going to get birthday announcements in Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Just think about it. Your Instagram birthday?
I know.
It's your birthday. Post a picture of yourself and we'll compare you to the last 11 birthdays you had. Blah, blah, blah. Everybody will wish you happy birthday in the comments. If Instagram's a new Facebook, they would be dumb not
I mean,
to
that,
that
would be the... So, I mean, I asked Facebook that, like, are you doing this on other properties? WhatsApp doesn't give you your birthdays, even though lots of people wish happy birthdays in there. It doesn't say your birth date. Instagram doesn't say your birth date. Twitter, by the way, does say your birthday if you've got it in there, but you have to, like, go to the person's profile, and it does like it shows balloons on the page. Is that great reporting or what?
It's some
that
amazing reporting. Yeah. I'm very impressed that you
100%.
Found out.
So eventually we're going to end up with
yes.
Come on,
did you hear Deepa's 100% which I
Thank
asked
you,
for
Deepa.
On the See, I was right about something. Deepa says 100%.
Deepa's very proud of all of us.
I mean, right, I desperately needed Deepa for this story because it was about Facebook. Felt like Deepa would know the most about Facebook birthdays. Hmm. Anyway.
That is true.
What Facebook's doing to birthdays is a horrible, terrible thing. And
if history is any indication, they're just going to put birthdays on, you know, 10 or 12 more platforms. So you'll never run out of ways to wish somebody a happy birthday. True. Or do what I do and just ignore them and not really care.
I know, David. And I was hurt you forgot my birthday this past year.
I wished you a happy birthday on Twitter yesterday, and I figure as long as I do it once a year, it kind of covers it. When your birthday is
not
so important.
I'm not even on Facebook. I had no idea you were having a birthday. See? This just shows you what the problem is.
I know. Or the problem is that Facebook...
zombies roam the streets and everybody's lonely on their birthday.
Or before the days of Facebook, nobody got birthday wishes.
We all got used to it, and now it's devastating when 500 people don't wish you a happy birthday.
It hurts your heart.
All right. Well, anyway, happy birthday to both of you. I really hope you have great days. Coming up, my interview with Matthew Carnahan, the creator of the new show Valley of the Boom.
If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Welcome back. Last Sunday on the National Geographic Channel, a new show premiered called Valley of the Boom. It's about the early days of the internet, following Marc Andreessen and Netscape, as well as a couple of other important companies who were trying to invent the future and make a crap load of money in the process. It's kind of a weird show, honestly. It's part documentary featuring lots of the people who were involved in these companies at the time. But it also has these long acted scenes. If you've ever seen House of Cards or The Big Short, you'll recognize a lot of the direct-to-camera stuff, which is sprinkled in there, too. There's also a tech company rap battle. So like I said, it's a weird show, but it's fun, and it's particularly interesting to go back to the 90s and see what the people who built the internet were thinking. I don't think they would have guessed how it was going to turn out 20-some years later. Anyway, the show was created and directed by Matthew Carnahan, who also created the show House of Lies and has written plays, a novel, and lots of other shows and movies you've probably seen. I called him a couple of days ago, just after the first episode aired, to see if I could figure out why he wanted to tell this story and what the early internet might tell us about where things are going next. A quick warning, there are occasional audio issues here because apparently after 20-some years of the internet, there's still no way to get reliable connection. So anyway, the first thing I asked Matthew was, have you been waiting to tell this story forever? Are you just a big old tech geek?
I love the show Silicon Valley, but I think I love that because it's a great piece of comedy, you know.
Fair.
I had friends in the 90s who were tech people and were, you know, had internet startups, and a few of whom actually escaped with the money. You know, I was one of those guys who was just happy to take the disk from AOL, and I was not like, oh, I got to have Netscape Navigator because that's the good one.
Right.
I didn't think about it that much. But when I started digging into, you know, the Netscape story, the story of the globe.com, of this kind of Facebook before Facebook, these 22-year-old kids in their dorm room, and at Cornell, and then this incredible low rent P.T. Barnum, Michael Fain, you know, who was turned out to be not Michael Fain at all. He was supposed to be doing 30 years in prison, but he escaped and became an internet startup guy, you know, raised $30 million without a credit card or a driver's license or a social security number. I began to see their value separately and discreetly just as great stories. And then, you know, with everything going on today in our, at the twilight of our internet 2.0 period with Cambridge Analytica and Facebook and, you know, Elizabeth Holmes and all of it, you know, it's a remarkable moment again, and the beginning probably of what we're all going to look back at as the real beginning of, you know, the real internet. So I don't know, it all started to really, really become a very compelling basis for something interesting. And then, you know, when I started pitching it to Nat Geo with Jada and STX, the idea was, you know, I said to them, I want to ruin your network. But maybe we can create a kind of a new thing and, you know, and just be incredibly cheeky and, you know, push against the kind of the existing docudrama paradigm.
Which is a very like tech Silicon Valley thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that is how I pitched it was, you know, let's be, to use a horribly overused word, you know, let's be as disruptive as the, you know, as the guys that we're making the stories about.
Well, and that's one of the things to me that's so striking about the show in general. Like, it kind of goes way out of its way to explain to people, like, no, you might forget, you know, 25 years later, but the internet at this moment was not only a huge deal, but nobody believed that it was a huge deal. And it was like, it was debatable in a way that the internet is not debatable now. It seems like it's like explaining, you know, oxygen is important. Everybody's like, yeah, I get it, but whatever, it's just sort of over there. But like, I don't know, I can't even imagine trying to explain to somebody who's, you know, 18 years old now, how important the internet was when it first started existing. That must have been a strange thing to figure out how to write into this show.
Yeah, it really was. It really was because, you know, I look at my kids, who one of them is 21 and one of them is 14. So one of them has grown up utterly immersed and completely immersed in social media, you know, and the other one was also, you know, marinated in it as well. And so I kept trying out stories on them, like, do you know that? And most of the time they would just kind of go, oh, well, yeah. But then when I started kind of really thinking, okay, well, you know, what's the equivalent? You know, like, my kids understand a rap beef, you know, so like, let's do a rap battle between, you know, Microsoft and Netscape. Like, how do you get that Bill Gates was totally gangster with the way that he just took them down and creating things like a Netscape and Microsoft rap battle, or a total Godfather assassination sequence when they're really coming after them and they decide to just bundle Internet Explorer with every computer, mm-hmm. which was the last nail in the coffin really for Netscape. You know, these companies were as big as they were, and none of them exist anymore.
Right. Well, and that was one of the undercurrents of the show that I thought was really interesting, because on the one hand, it is very sort of optimistic and excited about like the amazing things that these guys are doing. But on the other hand, the show sort of relentlessly comes back to money. And I live in Silicon Valley and nobody here wants to talk about money. It's all about, you know, we're making the world a better place and everything is terrific and look at our technology. And I kind of liked that the show is just over and over just like beating you on the head. Like, no, there's money here. Lots of people are in this for the money. Don't ever forget about the money. The money is so important. Was that important to just sort of like beat people over the head with, you know, fistfuls of dollar bills?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an interesting, bloody history, you know, yeah. And like part of the dirtiness and bloodiness of it is the high stakes of it. We're not at the Brooklyn Academy of Music making an avant-garde dance piece. You know, these guys are not only making things, they're making things with the expectation that they will crush their competitors and make billions of dollars in the process. And it's really important to see when you go from guys in their dorm rooms to guys getting worked by Bear Stearns. And all that stuff is still happening. You know, you're still dealing with kind of tacit or subtle manipulation of valuations in order to screw the young idealistic inventors as they, you know, excitedly make their way to the marketplace. You know, their pockets are being picked. You know, there's an uncomfortable meeting of innovation and commerce as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Silicon Valley and you know, it's a story as old as Silicon Valley and as old as long as there has been commerce, you know?
Yeah, it's true. So, I mean, did thinking about all this stuff that was happening then sort of change the way you think about the world as it is now? I mean, one criticism I've seen of the show is that it doesn't spend a ton of time sort of drawing explicit lines between what was going on then and where we are now. And I don't know if that was something you avoided on purpose, but like, did it change how you think?
Definitely avoided it on purpose. This show is, you know, we've got hopefully two more seasons of, you know, another season of Internet 2.0 and hopefully another season of Internet 3.0 and kind of the future, the present, the future. You know, we do spend a good piece of the final episode talking about how all of this affects where we are today. But that's not what this show is about. This show is about this season of this show is really about a moment. You know, it's about these fervent years of the tech boom and the tech bomb and how this amazing thing came together and then fell apart. A lot of my takeaway in terms of the boom bust cycle is it doesn't matter how spectacularly you blow up any given sector, whether it's tech, whether it's Silicon Valley, whether it's Wall Street, whether it's the real estate market, we're going to do it again. It's too sexy. It's too good. It's too juicy. We just want to like fly close to the sun, you know?
So if you were sitting down to make the right now, the season three of it, would it be all Bitcoin and blockchain and that kind of stuff? Like, are there other things you're keen on to for this moment in tech?
Right now, I mean, I think the story is, as we're in the twilight of our, you know, Internet 2.0, and I guess about 15 years, we've been going, hey, here's my photos, here's grandma, here's my personal information, take it, it's awesome, you know, like, what could possibly go wrong, you know, and cut to Brexit, and cut to our current political situation, and we're reaping what we have so generously sown. So I do think that the next chapter is about people slowing down, and I think it's about realizing even the most general of the general public maybe thinking a little bit more carefully about how to value privacy and anonymity. But at the same time, we're blabbing away in front of Alexa, you know, mm-hmm. and AI is kind of, you know, running a parallel course to this new concern with privacy and anonymity. And yeah, it's a really interesting moment.
And that's our show, everybody. Thanks to Matthew, Stu, Christopher, and Joanna for being here. And thank you for listening and for dealing with our audio sometimes. As usual, we have new episodes on Fridays, so make sure you subscribe to Instant Message on whatever podcast you use. I use Pocket Casts, in case you're wondering. As always, if you have feedback or ideas, email us at personaltech@wsj.com. We'll talk to you soon.